Welcome to Voter Information, the show that looks at elections in the city, the state, and the nation. I'm your election guru, Mark Brown here. Glad you could join us today. All right, so we are mostly going to be doing some miscellaneous things today. We're going to be reading some articles on some profile elected individuals. But first, we're going to start off with not exactly an obituary, but somebody has in fact passed away. This is from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Sunday, June 15, 2025. Minnesota legislature slain, another wounded. The Democratic officials and spouses were politically targeted in shootings that left two dead by Tim Sullivan and Alana Durkin Richer. Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. Hundreds of law enforcement officers fanned up out across a Minneapolis suburb Saturday in pursuit of a man who authorities say posed as a police officer and fatally shot a Democratic state lawmaker in her home in what Minnesota Governor Tim Walz called a politically motivated assassination. Authorities say the same suspect also shot and wounded a second lawmaker and was believed to be trying to flee the area. Minnesota State House Democratic leader Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark were killed in their Brooklyn Park home. State Senator John Hoffman, also a Democrat, and his wife Yvette were injured at their Champlin residence about 9 miles away. Drew Evans, superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, said at an afternoon news conference that authorities were looking for 57-year-old Vance Belter, whom he identified as the suspect. Authorities displayed a photo of Belter wearing a tan cowboy hat that was taken Saturday and asked the public to report sightings. Evans said investigators have obtained video as well. He did not give details on a possible motive. Belter is a former political appointee who served on the same state workforce development board as Hoffman, state records show, though it wasn't clear whether or how well they knew each other. Early morning attacks targeting lawmakers in the northern suburbs of Minnesota prompted warnings to other elected officials around the state and the cancellation of planned No Kings demonstrations against President Trump. Authorities say the suspect had No Kings flyers in his car and writings mentioning the names of the victims as well as other lawmakers and officials, though they could not say whether he had any other specific targets. The shootings happened at a time when political leaders nationwide have been attacked, harassed, and intimidated amid deep ideological divisions. We must all, in Minnesota and across the country, stand against all forms of political violence, Walz said in a news conference Saturday. Those responsible for this will be held accountable. Law enforcement has recovered several AK-style firearms from the suspect's vehicle, and he's believed to still be armed with a pistol, one of the people familiar with the matter told the AP. Police responded to reports of gunfire at the Hoffman's home shortly after 2 a.m., Champlin police said, and found the lawmaker and his wife Yvette with multiple gunshot wounds. After discovering who the victims were, police sent officers to check on Hortman's home, where they encountered what appeared to be a police vehicle and a man dressed as an officer at the door leaving the house. When officers confronted him, the individual immediately fired upon the officers who exchanged gunfire, and the suspect retreated back into the home and escaped, Brooklyn Police Chief Mark Brulee said. Bullet holes could be seen in the front door of the Hoffman's home. President Trump said in a White House statement that the FBI would join in the investigation. Our Attorney General Pam Bondi and the FBI are investigating the situation, and they will be prosecuting anyone involved to the fullest extent of the law. Such horrific violence will not be tolerated in the United States of America. God bless the great people of Minnesota, a truly great place. Hortman, 55, had been the top Democratic leader in the state house since 2017. She led House Democrats in a three-week walkout at the beginning of this year's session in a power struggle with Republicans. Under a power-sharing agreement, she turned the speakership over to the top Republican, Representative Lisa Dima, and assumed the title Speaker Emerita. Walz described Hortman as a formidable public servant, a fixture and a giant in Minnesota every day, determined to make the state a better place. She is irreplaceable, he said. Hortman and her husband had two adult children. Hoffman, 60, was first elected in 2012 and played a key role as chair of the Senate Human Services Committee, which oversees one of the biggest parts of the state budget. State Patrol Colonel Christine Bogovich asked people out of an abundance of caution not to attend any of the No Kinks protests that were scheduled across the state on Saturday. Bogojevich said authorities didn't have any direct evidence that the protests would be targeted, but said that the suspect had some No Kinks flyers in their car. Organizers announced that all of the protests scheduled in Minnesota were canceled. Belger was appointed to the Workforce Development Board by then-Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton in 2016 and was reappointed in 2019 by Waltz to a four-year term that expired in 2023, state records show. State corporate records show Belger's wife filed to create a company called Praetorian Guard Security Services with the same Green Isle mailing address listed for the couple. On a website for the business, Belger's wife is listed as the president and CEO, while he is listed as the director of security patrols. The company's homepage says it provides armed security for property and events and features a photo of an SUV painted in a two-tone black and silver pattern similar to a police vehicle with a light bar across the roof and Praetorian painted across the doors. Another photo shows a man in black tactical gear with a military-style helmet and a ballistic vest with the company's name across the front. An online resume says Belter is a security contractor who has worked overseas in the Middle East and Africa, in addition to his past managerial roles at companies in Minnesota. Hours after the shootings, hundreds of police officers and sheriff's deputies from agencies in the region, some in tactical gear with assault-style weapons, were scattered through the town. An alert sent to cell phones asked residents to continue sheltering in place as police were still looking for a suspect who was armed and dangerous. Suspect is white male, brown hair, wearing black body armor over blue shirt and blue pants, and may misrepresent himself as law enforcement. Do not approach, call 911, the alert said. Some roadblocks had been set up in which authorities stopped and checked vehicles. This is crazy, someone going after representatives. This is wrong. I'm hoping they'll catch him, said Brooklyn Park resident Douglas Thompson, 62. Demuth, the Republican House Speaker, called the attack evil and said she was heartbroken beyond words for the killings of Hoffman and her husband. With the law enforcement response going and details still emerging, I would simply ask all Minnesotans to please lift up in prayer the victims of this horrific attack, as well as the law enforcement personnel still working to apprehend the perpetrator, Demuth said in a statement. Former Representative Gabrielle Giffords, leader of Giffords, a National Gun Violence Prevention Group, said in a statement, "I am horrified and heartbroken by last night's attack on two patriotic public servants. My family and I know the horror of a targeted shooting all too well. An attack against lawmakers is an attack on American democracy itself. Leaders must speak out and condemn the fomenting violent extremism that threatens everything this country stands for." Giffords, an Arizona Democrat, was shot in the head in 2011 by a gunman who killed 6 people and injured 12 others. She stepped down from Congress in January 2012 to focus on her recovery. The shootings are the latest in a series of violent attacks against lawmakers across parties in recent years. In April, an assailant set fire to the home of Democratic Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, forcing him and his family to flee the building during the Jewish holiday of Passover. In July 2024, presumptive Republican presidential nominee Trump was grazed on the ear by one of a hail of bullets that killed a supporter. 2 months later, a man with a rifle was discovered in some shrubbery near Trump's golf course in Florida and arrested by Secret Service agents. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York said Saturday that he asked Capitol Police to immediately increase security for Minnesota Senators Amy Klobuchar and Tina Smith, both Democrats. He said he had also asked Senate Majority Leader John Thune, a Republican of South Dakota, to hold a briefing for senators on member security. That was Minnesota legislature slain, another wounded, by Tim Sullivan and Elena Durkin Richer. from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Sunday, June 15, 2025. Sullivan and Durkin Richer write for the Associated Press and reported from Brooklyn Park and Washington, respectively. AP writers Giovanna Del Orto in Champlin and Steve Karnowski in Minneapolis contributed to this report. And as of this show, folks, it is understood that the killer has, in fact, been caught. All right, on to some profile articles. This is from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Monday, April 21st, 2025. Lancaster mayor stance on homeless stirs furor. Rex Paris calls for free fentanyl for unhoused people and a purge by Trump, by Jessica Garrison. The mayor of Lancaster, Rex Paris, has ignited a controversy after musing during a council meeting that one approach to homelessness would be to give them free fentanyl, all the fentanyl they want. Paris, a larger-than-life trial lawyer, made the incendiary comments about the drug responsible for tens of thousands of overdose deaths during a February city council meeting in a retort to a resident who objected to all his musings of congregated unhoused residents into an encampment. It wasn't until Paris doubled down on his remarks during an interview with Fox LA that his statements went viral, provoking ire far beyond the high desert city where he has been mayor since 2008. He said that he didn't think anything had taken his comments literally, but that he did not regret them. In the interview, he said he wished for a purge of homeless people. I made it very clear I was talking about the criminal element that were let out of the prisons that have now become 40 to 45% of what's referred to as the homeless population, he said. They are responsible for most of our robberies, most of our rapes, and at least half of our murders, he said, without providing evidence to back up those assertions. He added, quite frankly, I wish the president would give us a purge because we need to purge these people. Now, is that harsh? Of course it is harsh. But it is my obligation as the mayor of the city of Lancaster to protect the hardworking families that live here, and I am no longer able to do it. It's an untenable situation. I want these people out of our city. Paris did not respond to the request for comment from the Times. His political opponents say they are outraged. Anyone willing to give homeless people all the fentanyl they want or to suggest that President Trump should allow a purge of the homeless population has no business in public office, said Jonathan Irvin, a Democrat who challenged and lost to Paris in last year's mayoral election. Irvin has now banded together with the third-place winner in that contest, Mark Maldonado, to try to recall the mayor. Paris has been a fixture in Lancaster for decades, first as a trial lawyer and civic leader, and for the last 15 years as mayor. The city, which sits in the Mojave Desert in northern Los Angeles County, has a population of about 175,000. According to figures from the Greater Los Angeles Homeless Count, reported in the Antelope Valley Press, there were 6,672 people experiencing homelessness in 2024, 1,989 more than in 2023. That includes the cities of Lancaster and Palmdale, as well as surrounding areas. Lancaster residents have become accustomed to a mayor with proposals that are often grand and sometimes quixotic. In 2013, when he made headlines when a bid to woo Chinese investment, he talked of opening a trade office in Beijing and building a Buddhist temple in his city. In 2018, he was back in the news for a proposal to make neckties optional among workers in the city, citing studies that they diminish blood flow to the brain. He has also long been a voice for law and order, and many in his city have taken a dim view of homelessness. In 2021, the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California released a report alleging widespread abuse of homeless people in Lancaster. The ACLU contended that the city had created a dragnet of criminalization in which deputies and city code enforcement officers regularly bulldoze encampments of unhoused people and order them to move by threat of citation. At the time, Paris said the city had done more than its share to serve its homeless population. He also said that he was trying to create an environment where people who are disabled can thrive and that he was not going to just let people live wherever they want, camp wherever they want, extort money from people who are shopping. That was Lancaster's Mayor's Stance on Homeless Stirs Furor by Jessica Garrison from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Monday, April 21st, 2025. All right, and now this one from the Los Angeles Times, Wednesday, April 30, 2025. Politician was an original influencer in OC's Little Saigon, and he still is, by Anne Doe. The textured mat is already on the table as Tony Lamb sits down to shuffle the polished tiles. He is here to participate in a ritual that he observes 4 days a week, a pursuit that keeps his head in shape. On this day, sitting in his daughter's house, he is competing against his wife, son-in-law, and grandson, all of whom build a wall of game pieces in front of them. It's Mahjong o'clock, and he's ready. One by one, they roll the dice to begin their match, dealing and betting a collection of quarters. Lamb quietly fears with a booming laugh, studies the spread, and then his cell phone pings. The original influencer of Little Saigon has been invited to another event, one of dozens each year, a commemoration of the Vietnamese immigration experience in America. He snares a suit of tiles and wins the coin within 11 minutes. Nothing seems to faze him. But as he prepares to make his next move, ping, it's an invitation to an informal coffee shop meeting followed by a business groundbreaking. Lamb, 88, has been a prominent fixture in Orange County's Little Saigon for decades. But his election to the Westminster City Council in 1992, the first Vietnamese-American to win political office in the United States, cemented his status. After 10 years, he announced his retirement from politics, but his continuing activism, even into his 80s, helped set in motion a series of political movements and cultural upheaval in Southern California. On Wednesday, the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, his community will be in the spotlight as news reports highlight the growth and influence of the Vietnamese community in Southern California. In Orange County, where 2020 census data showed nearly 242,000 residents of Vietnamese heritage, there are Vietnamese Americans on the City Council of Westminster, the original home of Little Saigon, Fountain Valley, Garden Grove, and Santa Ana. He's part of a wave of people that transformed California, said Jeffrey Brody, a retired professor of communications at Cal State Fullerton, who's writing a social history of the origins of Little Saigon. The reason the public pays attention to this group, especially locally, is because the community has invested in the building blocks of democracy. Lamb was there from the start, opening doors, collecting awards, trying to thread the needle in controversies that threatened to destabilize his community, and he's still filling his calendar with events, a reminder that his role as a trailblazer has not been forgotten. Lamb grew up in northern Vietnam, and made his way south after the country was split into two states. In the south, he held a series of jobs that brought him in contact with U.S. entrepreneurs and diplomats. At 28, he teamed with an older sibling, Dean, to manage their Lamb Brothers Corp. They were independent contractors unloading ammunition, building supplies and auto parts for the military at Camp Ron Bay, one of the busiest ports in the world. Lamb had learned English from his service in the Vietnamese Navy, and later, through job connections, he got his wife and 6 children on a flight out of their homeland before the fall of Saigon. Lamb says he stayed behind to help evacuate others. Then U.S. officials sent him to Guam, where he was assisting in the management of the newcomers there. After 3 months, he flew with his family to Camp Pendleton, where a large number of refugees were sent. Lamb was 37 years old, and he and his wife, 3 sons, and 3 daughters bunked in barracks on the base. He signed on as camp coordinator, trying to bring order to the confusion around him as thousands of adults and children immersed in resettlement. Eventually, he found an American sponsor, and we had the proverbial fresh start, he recalled, moving briefly to Florida before returning to the West Coast and renting an apartment in Huntington Beach. In Vietnam, Lamb had owned 3 companies. In Orange County, he took a job pumping gas and then as a supervisor in shipping and receiving for a firm that produced practice bombs for the Navy. It was such irony, said Lamb, who had fled a war just months before. His wife found work sanding guitars. When Lamb picked up her after her first day, he didn't recognize her right away because her head was covered with dust. Then he burst into tears. By the end of 1980, about 20,000 refugees were living in Orange County. Like their earlier counterparts, they had fled the communist regime, most of them drawn by news of relatives who had chosen to relocate there. Dan's Pharmacy, the first Vietnamese-owned business in the area, had opened its doors in 1978 in Westminster, a town that would quickly balloon into a bustling immigrant community dotted with produce markets, noodle houses, jewelry stores, and bakeries. Lam established a life insurance agency and an import-export business, and in 1984 opened Vien Dong, a restaurant in Garden Grove that quickly gained a following. The Little Saigon community expanded into neighboring cities, and in the 1980s, its restaurants, cafes, jewelry, and fabric shops and grocery stores started to attract attention throughout California. The first 99 Ranch Market opened in Westminster in 1984. In 1985, when a magnitude 8.0 earthquake hit Mexico City, killing almost 10,000 people, Lam organized a fundraiser. He was one of the founders of the Vietnamese American Chamber of Commerce and the Vietnamese American Lions Club in Westminster. A law and order conservative, he joined the Republican Party. Hop Lam, who had been married to him for 64 years, says he moves forward always with an eye to the past. He learns and he remembers. He was among the first organizers of the local Tet Festival to celebrate the Lunar New Year, which eventually became the largest celebration outside of Vietnam. He nurtured his businesses and was appointed to serve on Westminster's Traffic Commission in 1989. In addition, he befriended the white families, the Mexican families, and everyone he talked to, Brody said. When he ran for city council to win, he had to have the support of the Caucasians and the Latinos, as well as the Asians. Lam's daughter, Kathy Lam, said, "When there was something to be done, my father never hesitated. Public service for him is a way to include everyone in decisions and solving problems." His community was bound together by family, tradition, and staunch anti-communist sentiment, which in a few years fueled a controversy that foreshadowed a political shift in Little Saigon. In 1994, the U.S. lifted its trade embargo against Vietnam and resumed diplomatic ties the following year. Longtime residents of Little Saigon were incensed and organized anti-communist protests. That anger, however, was not universal, evidenced by the interest among a few local merchants in the possibility of expanding their market by doing business in Vietnam. A few later, in January 1999, Trung Van Tran posted a communist flag and photo of Ho Chi Minh, the late communist leader, in his video store, which was on Bolsa Avenue, Little Saigon's main thoroughfare. Community protests started immediately. On January 21st, an Orange County judge temporarily ordered Tran to remove the items, but she soon reversed herself on February 10, saying the flag and the photo constituted protected speech. The demonstrations continued for 53 days. At one point, the crowd grew to about 15,000. Lam did not join them. He said he understood the anger, but City Attorney Richard D. Jones told him and Westminster officials to stay away. They needed to stay neutral to avoid legal action. Because Lam was a no-show, protesters picketed outside his restaurant for 73 days. He was called a communist sympathizer, and political rivals vilified him. He hired a lawyer in an attempt to stop the chaos in front of the restaurant. Speaking at a council meeting in February of that year, he said his heart had been torn apart. He left office in 2002. It was the greatest trial of his political life, Lam said, remembering his efforts to balance his loyalty to his Vietnamese community with the city's interests. During the tumult, some younger members of the Vietnamese community already questioning their status on the sidelines of a local political infrastructure that didn't include them, inserted themselves in the conversation. Lan Quoc Nguyen, who had been an attorney for only 3 years, got involved by negotiating with city staff and police to allow the protesters to stay around the store property for hours on end. Pretty soon, we realized that in order to gain respect, to be listened to by people who run the greater society, we had to have a seat at the table. We started digging in, Nguyen said. Nguyen, along with Van Tran, the first Vietnamese-American elected to the Garden Grove City Council in 2000, described the movement as political empowerment. They gathered volunteers from massive voter registration drives, one after another in consecutive elections, offering cokes and banh mi and often free entertainment from top refugee musical acts in the inaugural Rock and Vote and Get Out the Vote gatherings were staged at UC Irvine and parks with one consistent element, constant element, handy translators to interpret English language materials. This is what cemented political power, Brody said. Not having anyone to recruit their opinions or participation, the Vietnamese organized themselves into a powerful voting bloc, and from then on, you saw all kinds of candidates running for all kinds of seats. In 1975, when the Vietnamese came over, Kathy Lamp said, we all worried about putting food on the table. Over the years, as our kids got older, as all of us understood more about U.S. history, the Civil Rights Act, the Clean Water Act, the Affordable Care Act, what the EPA stands for, we became a little less conservative, a little more moderate. At the end of the day, the community sees it's making money. They have to give back by getting deeply involved in politics. Today, in Orange County, there are at least 24 Vietnamese Americans in city and county offices, and there are others on school boards, sanitation and water boards, and in Orange County's Superior Court. Trai Tha, Westminster's first Vietnamese American mayor, is serving in the state assembly, and last year, Derek Tran became the first Vietnamese American from California elected to federal office representing the 45th congressional district. Tran met Lam at his swearing-in ceremony in December. I've known his name for a long, long time, said Tran, who ousted Republican stalwart Michelle Steele in a competitive congressional race. His daughter and her son walked the neighborhoods and knocked on doors for me, helping me get elected. Without having someone like him, it would have not been possible for me to have my seat here. He truly blazed the trail. During the event, Lam kept pulling Tran aside to say how proud he was of the younger man, prompting the new congressman to add, it makes me so happy to hear that from someone of his stature. Terry Raines, an activist who launched the Westminster Buzz Facebook page and has been a steady presence at council meetings since 2019, says she expects to see more Tony Lams in office, but you can't ignore the Andrew Doe thing. Last October, Doe, a former Orange County supervisor, admitted guilt in funneling more than $10 million in federal pandemic funds through a nonprofit linked to his daughter. He received more than $550,000 in bribes from money slated to buy meals for elderly Little Saigon residents, shocking the political establishment of the county. Lam called it a tragedy, but his phone still pings with political newbies scheduling appointments to visit with him for advice, an endorsement, or a donation. He kept his profile as one of the originals in Little Saigon, said Van Tran, who ascended to state office as the first Vietnamese-American elected to California's assembly. He inspires because he is outspoken and true to himself. My intention is to help everyone, said Lam, at a recent playground dedication at Westminster's Tony Lam Park. That's how I operate. That was politician, was an original influencer in OC's Little Saigon, and he still is, by Anne Doe. From the Los Angeles Times, Wednesday, April 30, 2025. On to another neighboring city, Huntington Park. From the California section, the Los Angeles Times, Friday, May 2, 2025. In Huntington Park, politics resembles WrestleMania. Who are the heroes and heels? City council meetings easily dissolve into municipal desmadre by Gustavo Arellano, columnist. In the eternal spinning wheel that's political scandal in Southeast LA County, the ticker is now on Huntington Park, and looks like it'll be stuck there for a while. The blue-collar, overwhelmingly Latino city faces a lawsuit by former councilmember Esmeralda Castillo, who alleges she was illegally removed in February in the wake of an investigation that determined Castillo didn't live within the city limits and was thus ineligible to serve. Mayor Arturo Flores is battling a recall by opponents who claim on social media he's a reckless alcoholic and abuses women while offering no evidence to back up the scurrilous claims. His predecessor, Councilmember Karina Macias, woke up on February 26 to the sound of LA County District Attorney's Office investigators outside her apartment with a search warrant as part of Operation Dirty Pond. That's an investigation that into a proposed $25 million aquatics center for Salt Lake Park that was first announced in 2019, but so far has nothing to show except a half a football field and a fenced-off field of dirt and dying grass. Also served were Councilmember Eddie Martinez, two former council members, and City Manager Ricardo Reyes, and even Huntington Park City Hall, which saw yellow caution tape blocked off the front entrance as investigators carried out evidence. Then there's longtime city attorney Arnold Alvarez Glassman, who resigned during a special council meeting in early March, just 2 days after the Operation Dirty Pond raids. He claimed that Flores and his council allies had made his job unreasonably difficult. Is it any wonder now that city council meetings nowadays easily dissolve into even more municipal desmadre? While malfeasance in politics happens in all parts of Southern California, the level of skullduggery and sometimes outright thievery by council members in Southeast LA County cities over the last 3 decades has made this area's politics infamous. There was Southgate, where former mayor and treasurer Albert Robles was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison in 2006 on corruption charges, and an elderly council member survived a gunshot wound to the head in a case that was never solved. And Bell, where five former council members and two city staffers were convicted in the mid-2010s of fleecing residents for decades. It's local politics as WrestleMania. Huntington Park was supposed to be different, a city where a new generation of politicians who helped to take out the previous baddies repeatedly reassured the public that they would break the corruption cycle. That's what they told me last year when I did a series on the history of Latino politics in Los Angeles. Well, here we are. At the April 17 meeting, Flores bragged that he wore Macias' vote against him to succeed her as mayor like a badge of honor, because I definitely do not want her support, which the audience reacted with groans and mutters of, oh, God. A few weeks later, as Nancy Martinez was being sworn in to fill Castillo's former seat, Macias focused on her cell phone like someone waiting for an Uber ride. "Your background is just corruption," Ruby Cruz told the council at the April 7 meeting during the public comment section. "It's like oysters to a rock. It's hard to get them off." Afterward, I asked him if he thought Flores' ascension represented a fresh start for the Huntington Park. The 48-year-old resident laughed. "There's others waiting like vultures for an animal to die," Cruz replied. "Here in Huntington Park, the immoral becomes moral, the illegal becomes legal." I interviewed Flores and Macias at the site of their choice to size them up and decide who came off as truthful and who was full of it. The loquacious Flores, a self-admitted peleonero, a fighter who served his first term, showed up to Salt Lake Park in a cart hatch jacket embroidered with the city seal and his name. Macias, calm and dressed in a modest black blouse and jeans, picked a Mexican ice cream shop where she slowly enjoyed a scoop of Rocky Road inside a waffle cone. Both are children of Mexican immigrants who grew up in blue-collar neighborhoods, Flores in South LA, Macias in Huntington Park. They have worked in jobs that require selflessness and attention to detail. Flores was a Marine bomb dog trainer with tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, and Macias became a full-time caretaker for her parents. They were former political allies who previously worked on political campaigns for Efren Martinez, the Southeast LA County power broker, who lost an assembly race last year, and whose residence and consulting business were also searched as part of Operation Dirty Pond. "This is the Karina Macias legacy, you know," the 38-year-old Flores told me as we walked around Salt Lake Park. People jogged around the fenced-off lot, which was once a skating park. It's a failed pool project riddled with inconsistencies, riddled with questionable acts, and questions of legality and incompetence. There, Flores and his allies putting a gray, dark cloud on something that can change the lives of the community, Macias, 38, replied when I shared his thoughts. She has sat on the city council since 2013. There was no wrongdoing or things being hidden or money misspent or being stolen. What he's saying what he's saying, there's nothing of that, you know? Both used you know a lot in our conversations, like any typical Latino Angelino. Both claim the community is behind them and welcome to any and all scrutiny. I'm not panicking, you know what I'm saying? The 36-year-old Flores boasted. I'm cool like a cucumber. If you don't have enemies, then you're not pushing the buttons or trying to do good for the community, Macias, 38, offered with a hint of pride. This isn't her first brush with scandal. In 2017, the DA investigated and ultimately cleared her of raising money for an Efren Martinez assembly campaign from companies that sought to do business with Huntington Park. This time around, Macias presented me with a folder of documents that included a timeline of the Salt Lake Park Aquatic Center, complete with all the council votes in its favor, including a 2013 motion that gave Huntington Park City Manager the authority to execute all contracts associated with the projects. Among the yes votes then, Flores. The mayor decided just to make something out of nothing because he's known about the project since the time that he started, Macias said matter-of-factly. Later on, as we walked down Pacific Avenue, she handed me her business card. She noticed it was out of date. It still says mayor, Macias said, a small smile on her face. Don't tell the mayor. Flores handed me no documents, but something perhaps more powerful, a confessional. After working in L.A. county politics for a decade, including serving as a bodyman for Antonio Villaraigosa during his failed gubernatorial campaign, Flores moved to Huntington Park in 2018. I'm not going to say there wasn't a political ambition there, he admitted. He helped on the successful 2020 city council campaigns for Eddie Martinez, Graciela Ortiz, and Marilyn Sanabria. The latter two also saw their residencies searched as part of Operation Dirty Pond. Flores said they and Macias initially sold him on the Salt Lake Park pool project. I felt inspired. I thought it was a beautiful thing, he said. I'm like, this is what we need. Latinos need this. Why can't we have nice things in our community, right? They told him that criticism by watchdogs were just los haters, but Flores said his perspective changed once he was appointed to the city council in 2022 and he went to City Hall during a rainstorm. The staff had 30-gallon trash cans filled up with water. There's mold on the walls. The roofs are leaking. I went to the city manager's office and I said, hey, like, you know, excuse my French, but what the F's going on here? The subsequent fire hose of allegations he unleashed during our hour-long chat seemed haphazard compared to Macias' measured responses. Humble brags by Flores, like, every time that they've tried to maneuver against me, they're met with an insurmountable reaction because I've already anticipated that that's their tactics, sounded like the words of someone asking to be hoisted on their proverbial petard. But Macias did herself no favors when she insisted Efren Martinez had zero involvement with the Salt Lake Park pool project. One of the clients he listed on campaign disclosure forms for his failed 2020 assembly race was the construction company whose owner sought their residence searched for Operation Dirty Pond as well. Flores and Macias were both pleasant unless their subject was each other. They struck me as earnest about improving Huntington Park and confided their innocence of what opponents claim about them. But one of them has to be wrong, right? As a tiebreaker, I called up former assembly member Hector De La Torre, who entered politics a quarter century ago to help cleanse his hometown of Southgate. He's now executive director of the Gateway Cities Council of Governments, which advocates for 27 cities stretching from Montebello to Long Beach to Cerritos and all of the Southeast LA County cities. He has worked with Flores and Macias in that capacity. De La Torre praised both of them for their dedication to better Huntington Park and urged they let Operation Dirty Pond investigators do their job. But in a wary tone, he told me in SELA, sometimes it isn't about someone getting rid of corruption and cleaning up the city. SELA is the nickname for Southeast LA County. Sometimes it's two different factions, both as shady as the other, he said. And the swings are not from corruption to good government. They're from one type of corruption to another. That was, in Huntington Park, Politics Resemble WrestleMania, Who Are the Heroes and Heels? By Gustavo Arellano, columnist, from the California section of the Los Angeles Times for Friday, May 2nd, 2025. Folks, that'll do it for this edition of Voter Information. Until next time, everybody, this is your election guru, Mark Brun, saying to you, happy voting, and of course, peace.